This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on July 13th, 2017. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
We will take up a draft advisory opinion 2017-05, Great American PAC and Committee to Defend President. Mr. Backer?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Let's see, Council, I'd like to begin.
Thank you, Chairman Walther. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 1730A and 1730B are draft responses to an advisory opinion request submitted by Great America PAC and the Committee to Defend the President. The requesters asked several questions regarding the application of the Act and Commission regulations to proposals to use Twitter handles and disclaimers on certain communications and to maintain Twitter profiles without a disclaimer. Both drafts conclude that the Great America PAC may use its Twitter handle in lieu of its full name and disclaimers, that the Committee to Defend the President may include its Twitter handle along with its full name as long as the disclaimer's language makes clear that the committee is paying for the communication, but that neither committee may use Twitter handles as an alternative to their permanent street address, telephone number, or World Wide Web address. The drafts differ, and that Draft A concludes that neither committee's Twitter profile page needs to include a disclaimer, while Draft B concludes that they do. Draft B also concludes that the requesters may not satisfy the disclaimer requirement by including a graphic bearing the standard disclaimer if such graphic is not available on certain mobile devices. We did not receive any comments on the request or Draft B, and one comment on Draft A. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Any questions, comments?
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Goodman.
I would just like to ask Mr. Backer's reaction to drafts A and B.
Well, thank you. To the extent that the drafts agree on the use of the Great America Act, Great America PAC in lieu of the name, of course we concur. To the extent that the drafts tend to agree on most other things, we're not really going to argue that, but I do want to raise a concern about the nature of the disclaimer. Disclaimers, of course, are an important and necessary component of the disclosure regime that we have, but the purpose of the URL or the name the address or the phone number is not really informational. It's communicative. And I would be concerned that Twitter is a much more effective means of engaging in communication than the URL or the phone number or the address, and that we're looking almost at form over substance in affecting the goal of the regulations here. The address goes on the disclaimer so people can mail you a letter. Not that anyone's going to come and show up at the office, hopefully. You have a phone number so they can call you. You have a URL so they can go to that website and communicate with this committee. And so the purpose isn't just say, hey, here is this piece of information that is otherwise useless. It exists only for the purpose of engaging or allowing the viewer, the reader, the listener to engage with that political committee in some manner. And in that context, Twitter is a vastly more effective means of communication than any of those three options combined. And so I realize that the regulations say what the regulations say, and that our position would be that this would be a more effective this would better fulfill the intent of the regulation. I understand that the commission doesn't see it that way, but I think going forward that it is elevating form over substance and really not getting at the goal of what that piece of information is there for. Beyond that, I wanted to where did I put that phone? I wanted to raise the issue of whether or not we can see the disclaimers on Twitter profiles using graphics if we're required to have them. And so the concern that I had was if I go to Twitter right now and I pull up the Committee to Defend the President's Twitter profile, there is a disclaimer on the graphic. It happens to be a standard graphic that is used a lot. And it's actually the text is 4% of the vertical height of the graphic. It is in the printed box, and it is basically unreadable even to me looking at it from here. And my eyes are bad, but they're not that bad. And so my concern is that with respect to the different devices, different size devices, different operating systems on devices, they all treat this differently. And so our concern is that we don't really know what device somebody's going to be using to look at a particular the Twitter page, the profile. And so it doesn't really make sense to exclude our ability. If we have to have the disclaimer there, we want to be able to include it in that graphic and not have to try to measure it against something like 50 or 60 different devices and device sizes and operating systems. That said, we also don't think that the profile requires a disclaimer, or that the limited amount of permissible profile space, that the 160 characters of text that we have there, should be used for the purposes of just the disclaimer. While these clients aren't using that space right now to engage in a communication, they could. Going into that situation, losing 86 out of 160 characters in order to create the disclaimer envisioned in draft B would be very limiting in the rest of their speech that they'd be able to engage in that very tiny space. Those are sort of the major comments. I did want to raise one other, or two other mild, somewhat random issues. The first, in both drafts, on draft A, it's page 2, line 1. The draft says, and they assert they plan to make independent expenditures. I would point out both organizations have made extensive independent expenditures this year and have done so just this week. So I don't know that. I wanted to avoid any potential, like, oh, hey, it's hypothetical. These groups are very actively doing this. And then on draft A, page 8, lines 11 and 12, there's a sentence that begins, moreover, a Twitter handle, unlike a domain name, gives no information about what type of organization it references, for example, .com, .org, or .gov. I would suggest that that really is incorrect as factual matter, because other than .gov, any organization can have any domain TLD, the .com or .org that it wants. There's no restraint on it, so it doesn't really convey any information. So, for example, if I go to GoDaddy right now and I try to search for stupidregulations.gov, it'll tell me that I can't have that URL, but I can have the .com version, the .org version, .online, and a long list of other different TLDs. So there's not really any the statement just happens to be factually untrue. And so I thought it would be better for the commission to strike that rather than have that in the language.
Mr. Gibbon.
Just a follow-up question. That was a lot to take in.
Yeah, sorry.
Now, can you delineate, let's start then with draft A. How does draft A implicate these concerns that you've addressed? I understand the specific page 2, line 1, page 8, lines 11 to 12 issues. How are your concerns that you've addressed broadly addressed in draft A?
Well, we agree with the outcome of question one with respect to the use of the name of the organization or the Twitter handle of the organization in the lieu of the name, because the Twitter handle is identical to the name absent the spacing. With respect to questions two. I'm going to skip question two and go to question three, which is more about the use of the Twitter handle in lieu of the URL. So when we put out a communication that says, vote for against the candidate X, paid for by @Great America PAC, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee, www.greatamericapac.com. Our approach to this is we're paying for this communication in either space or time or both. And the consumption of this space or this time is limited. We only have so much space, so much time to communicate. We're paying for it. We don't want to lose that piece of communication space, that URL. And if we have to lose that little piece of the communication, that, even if it's 1 second out of 15 seconds, that's when we have a $100,000 communication, this has some real value to the organization with respect to its speech. We would, the organization, and especially the individuals who create the media content, who create TV ads, radio ads, all the different communications, who regularly yell at me over why do we have to have this disclaimer, it would be substantially beneficial to drive them to the Twitter handle. So @Great America PAC, or paid for by @Great America PAC, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee, is substantially better and a better use of donor resources than paid for by @Great America PAC, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee, www.greatamericapac.com, because it gives us 1 or 2 seconds more of communication time. And at the same time, it also is a better mechanism of engaging people with our activities. People are our experience is that people engage with this organization on Twitter. very few people go to the website and submit an online comment or do things there. It's not, websites are essentially static because we have a Twitter profile that allows people to communicate. So both from affecting the goal of this informational disclaimer requirement, that is giving the recipient, the reader, the listener, the hearer, or viewer rather, something to engage with us, Twitter is more effective. And it would allow us to, these clients to more effectively engage in communications. And it removes this even incremental, but some substantial cost in terms of the space and time that they are paying to communicate their message in.
Did you want to go through the other? I'm at a granular level trying to understand your reaction to the answers that are being proposed in drafts A and B. So let's start with draft A. You've been through one and three.
Mm-hmm. Well, two, I think two is sort of precatory with getting to three. Whether having the name of the organization and the Twitter handle would be sufficient was, I think, was a lead into this idea that, and we don't need the URL there. Obviously, we could always put the URL, the Twitter handle, in with the existing disclaimer. So we could always say, paid for by the Committee to Defend the President, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee, www.committeetodefendthepresident.com, that's about 2 seconds at my fast pace, @defend_Trump. So we could put it there. There's not a prohibition on including additional information in the box disclaimer. I see that fairly regularly. It could be elsewhere. Again, we want to minimize the portion of the mandatory text. So our goal was, hey, is this enough? And if so, then can we not have in three, can we have the Twitter completely remove the URL? In four, so if we're driving people to our Twitter page, there's not a lot of space to communicate. We've got the profile picture, we've got the header bar, we have the 160 characters, and we can put the URL in there. I think it was draft B actually itemized it in the footnote that the disclaimer would be approximately 86 characters out of that 160 characters that would be in the box. And so if we're, again, there's a limited amount of bandwidth in which to convey this communication. It's a space question. And while right now there's not a communication going on in that space that would be supplanted, if we're required to have that disclaimer there, then it would prevent the organization from engaging in speech on this platform in that tiny little sliver of space. I tend to agree, however, with draft A that Twitter profiles don't require a disclaimer at all, but to the extent that draft B says that they do, we disagree. We would like to be able to use the graphic section that we showed and not have to worry about whether or not every individual device could read them. And that runs through questions five and, I believe, six of draft A. Keep going,
please.
On B. And so on B, the principal difference in draft B is, of course, Twitter profiles require a disclaimer. We tend to follow, as we laid out in the advisory opinion request, we think that the history here is that no, they don't, because of the nature of the Twitter profile and the way it's used. The fact that we ultimately don't have control over the content because, for example, Milo Yiannopoulos found out, you say stuff they don't like, you're gone. And so it's not our platform. We're just sitting there. And so we don't think a disclaimer is required. And again, to the extent that it would be required, it ought to be satisfied by the use of the graphic, which frees up that potential 86 or characters out of 160, so half the potential communicative space. And again, with so many different platforms, it would be very hard for us to figure out how to construct the graphic appropriately to make it work. And I imagine there's probably even, I have iPhone model this is, but there's older ones, they may not properly render the graphic at all. We can't really control sort of the mechanics of that. So we want to create something that, if we're required to have a disclaimer, we want it to be the least obstructive possible to the potential communication and not have to try to account for every conceivable scenario that could occur.
Do I walk away with, right, understand that your principal concern with draft A is the answer to number three?
I would say that would be our biggest concern with that draft. Yes, we would encourage the commission to reconsider that its answer to that, to elevate the substance over the form.
remind me of a fact here. Great America PAC and Committee to Defend the President, do they have street addresses?
They do.
Are they P.O. boxes?
They have street addresses. The Committee to Defend the President uses 203 South Union in Alexandria, and Great America PAC uses 107 South Lee Street, number, I think, 555. But they're the addresses that are filed on their FEC forms.
And do they have World Wide Web addresses?
They do.
They do.
Both of their full names constitute their web addresses.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can imagine, committeetodefendthepresident.com is a mouthful.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue.
Yes, of course.
On the one hand, we've had some disagreements here on the commission on what Twitter is, and and I've tended to agree with your position that it is Twitter's platform, not yours. You control your World Wide Web address. That's yours. You control the content in it. Twitter is someone else's website that controlled by the company.
Yeah.
And you're there. You're allowed to use it subject to their conditions. And some of those are substantive and content conditions. So on the one hand, we're saying you're saying, so you agree with us that Twitter is not the website controlled by you.
Correct.
Okay. But you do want to use Twitter to identify you in your sort of like that you're saying that it is the equivalent of a World Wide Web address. So looks like there you're adopting Twitter as your identifying address to identify you.
I would think of it as a channel because we intend to have the full address of the World Wide Web address on the Twitter page, and so it'd be it's almost like going to www.nationbuilder.com/packx, where it's somebody else's page, but it's a mechanism to drive. It's a channel essentially, and it ultimately even if it by itself does not provide an adequate communicative mechanism. And I think Twitter is a much better communicative mechanism. It also links back to the ultimate web page that would still exist.
And your once I land at your Twitter channel or your Twitter feed, there I find your permanent street address, telephone number, or World Wide Web address posted somewhere on there.
The World Wide Web address, yes,
but not your permanent street address or telephone number.
No.
Okay. So your concern carries on into the answer to number four as well on draft day, which is the same issue. You cannot substitute a Twitter address for a URL address.
Correct.
Go back and explain to me one more time, Dan.
Which part?
Why a URL address in a disclaimer is more onerous than a Twitter address?
Sure. There's three factors. The first is that from the perspective of the quality of a communication, we have a very limited bandwidth, whether it's space and time to communicate that message. The Twitter handle is a more effective part of the communication. It's better communicative. It's more communicative. It fits better with the branding. It allows the organization to better engage. So, for example, At Great America PAC, or paid for by At Great America PAC, not authorized by any candidates or candidates committee, without the URL, is both shorter. So we're saving time, space, and money, which means more of the rest of the content. Even if it's just a printed disclaimer, it's only one line, but it's still that's one line less of speech. At the same time, it gives one piece of information as opposed to multiple pieces of information where we want people to go and to engage with the organization. It is substantially more communicative, which is, I think, the goal and the substance behind this particular regulation. It's not informational, it's communicative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a more effective use of this limited space that we have. I can anecdotally, I can tell you, I've never had a, of all the ads that we approve and all the communications that we approve to make sure all the disclaimers are correct, it is an endless source of frustration for the people that are the actual creators of content that we have to put this in there. I've never met one of them who didn't say, oh, do we really have to do this? Can we just not do it? And obviously the answer is no, you have to do it, but it takes away the bandwidth and the quality of the communication. It adds to the cost. And I don't think it's as effective at delivering the value that we want, this connection between the recipient of the communication and the maker of the communication.
And you're talking about for online communications or all communications?
I think really all communications, whether it's TV, radio, print.
And you use Twitter instead of URL on all of those.
Yeah, we would like to. So we encourage a global, an overly inclusive global disclaimer from all of our clients. And we that way, in the off chance that somebody decides, hey, let's use this disclaimer here because the lawyer's not around right now and we need to get it done, we have an over-inclusive disclaimer. So across the board, we want to be able to advise this is what you use so we know it fits in every scenario. Even if it might not technically be required in one particular place, if we can do it, we want to do it.
Okay. On devices, which you mentioned, I understand the character limitation.
Right.
Okay. We have a small items exemption mm-hmm. that from time to time has been debated on the commission for disclaimers on devices. Mm-hmm. But for television and print and direct mail, how is it that your communication is somehow impinged upon if you have to use the URL as opposed to a Twitter? When, mm-hmm. so long as you provide the URL or the permanent street address, you could always add your Twitter handle as well. I mean, you're not across media. This does not impinge upon space for communication across all media, does it?
I would say that it does. First, so there's two different requests.
Hold on, but I got to challenge that. Okay. You send a direct mail piece,
uh-huh.
requires a disclaimer.
Mm-hmm.
The commission insists on the plain language of its mm-hmm. statute and regulations and says you got to use a street address, telephone number, or World Wide Web address. And by the way, if you want to add your Twitter handle somewhere in there, you can. But you have unlimited space pretty much in a direct mail piece. I mean, this adding the URL address is not going to squeeze out any communicative content in a direct mail piece.
Granted, but the quality of the communication suffers because at www.thecommitteetodefendthepresident.com is a very long URL, and people don't engage in the internet the way they do now. Giving people at defend_Trump both better conveys the intent and the message and the goal of the organization, as well as provides a better and more effective means of communication. And given the option
not
between one channel or two, but we want to channel them into the one. If we can.
Get it, but so now you're talking. I see, but it you want to channel people. I see.
Right. To the most effective form of communication. So if we have to have, if we're going to put both of them there, that's going to, that is consuming some space. Now, granted, it's a very limited amount of space. It's much more of an issue when we're talking about oral disclaimers or screen and print disclaimers.
Well, screen and print, I understand. I don't think we have fully fleshed out the potential application of the small items exemption here, which has been a point of some debate on the commission. And I might, Mr. Chairman, want a little more time to consider that issue if we distinguish between media.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're looking at channeling as a practical matter, we could have you comply with our act, it seems to me, provide a street address, which doesn't really channel anybody anywhere in the
right.
in the cyber world, and you could always add your Twitter handle for the channel. The channeling only comes if you feel compelled to use your URL address. Then you say to me, you're forcing me to channel people to my URL address when I prefer to channel them to my web presence at Twitter. My point is, for other media, such as print media, mm-hmm. adding the Twitter as an add-on, there's no prohibition as to that. So how much? I understand the space limitations on characters online, okay, but for other media, it doesn't seem to me we are eliminating the room for communicative content.
It's not eliminating the room, but if the goal is to have a uniform model of communication so that everyone receives essentially the same disclaimer information so that it's uniform across recipients, and we want to have the Twitter handle there because it's the most effective means of communication, and so we have the Twitter handle and some other mechanism of communication in the disclaimer, whether it's the address or the URL. So now we've got two different pieces. which one does the recipient of the communication choose? Yes. Obviously, we wanted them to use the one main communication model that is most likely to affect the communication. It doesn't squeeze out the 18 or 20, however many characters of ink that's of used there. I agree that it's not really taking up space, but it affects the quality and the character of the communication and the ability to effectively engage with that audience. The goal
isn't that an argument that people have made about disclaimers all along, that they somehow force us to speak in a certain way, and they somehow, I mean, yeah.
And I would
we do have a disclaimer
with the
validity
of that, but it's the regulation does require it, and it is an important part of the system that we have to have disclaimers so people know who's speaking.
Yes.
And through the street address, phone number, or URL, a mechanism to contact that speaker, in which I think the Twitter handle is optimal. There's also, I think, in terms of the clarity and the ability for the non-lawyered up political organization to have, a simpler rule is probably the better rule. And that being able to say, or your Twitter handle, you can use your Twitter handle here, but not here or here, adds a layer of complexity to these activities. As I'm sure you know, there's been an explosion in the amount of grassroots political speech in the small and mid-dollar range over the last several years, and there's a lot of people who are engaging in political activity who don't have lawyers and are reading the 2008 copy of the Non-Connected Committee Guide out there and not really sure what that requires of them.
Mr. Chairman, for your indulgence.
Of course.
Dan, I apologize. I didn't reread your request for today's meeting. Was it clear in your request that you were asking about this use of Twitter versus URL in your disclaimer across all media of communication?
I don't know that we specified it in that language, but we did ask to, instead of the URL, just use the Twitter handle. So I would say it would probably be implied, not explicit.
Well, it's just striking me now that there may be different results depending on the media that you are using. And as to non-uniformity, I mean, there is a position on this commission that there could be non-uniformity, i.e. in the sense that in print, you'd have to have the full disclaimer, and on a device, you might not have to have a disclaimer at all because it's a small item, and that's non-uniformity. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll defer to any other questions, but I might want to take a little more time with the permission of Mr. Backer.
Of course.
Happy to grant to defer an outcome on this if that's helpful to the commission. I don't think we're up against the time clock either.
All right. Well, I wouldn't mind having a little more time to consider it myself, to be honest with you. Mr. Peterson.
Just one quick question. And I think taking a little bit of extra time to just look at this is probably not a bad idea. Even if one's sympathetic with the argument that you're making, the problem we run into is the specificity of the statutory language, which it could have been written differently, and it's sometimes the problem when statutory language is written so specifically in light of the technologies and available means of communication at the time. But it does say that for non-authorized communications, it shall clearly state the name and permanent address, telephone number, or worldwide web address of the person who paid for the communication, and state that the communication is not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. No, there's no catch-all or some equivalent signifier or designation. So in terms of the specificity of the statutory language, how does the commission get out of that box and move beyond and start considering other pieces of information as meeting the commands of this language?
So the first thing that occurs to me is bit.ly, bit.ly. Are you familiar with this? So it's link shortening. So, for example, yeah. I can own www.thecommitteetodefendthepresident.com. I can go to bit.ly, and that's the whole URL. Enter that URL in there. They'll give me a short URL. It'll be 123, I'm making this up, but 123456 .bit.ly. That, if I put that URL into our disclaimer, that is that directly takes you to the URL, and it would constitute a URL, an appropriate use of the disclaimer. But no one would want to do that because it's meaningless gibberish, these short URLs. So the advance of technology, has broadened what is the World Wide Web. When the World Wide Web was written in this context, you didn't have Twitter. I don't think you had Facebook. I didn't think you had a lot of this stuff. You just had message boards and discussion platforms and emails. And I think the commission need not elevate the specificity of the language written at a time before any of this technology existed and became tremendously dominant in our political communications process. In fact, really, as a principal means of communication in a lot of industries and amongst people generally. I don't think you're bound to only look at it that way. It would be like, say, I'm trying to think of a really good analogy, and I can't come up with one, but I think there are plenty of examples where this commission has, in light of the evolving technology, has said, look, this may have been the specific statutory language, but we see this inclusive of this language. In fact, the commission just now created a new descriptive category for appropriate reporting purposes for home security systems that would have been outside the scope of the statute, but it understood that, look, times have changed. We need to recognize that, and that this is a reasonable understanding within the confines of the language. I think here as well, what is the World Wide Web has dramatically changed, and I think it is the commission has the ability to recognize that evolution, those changes within this context.
Oh, go ahead. No. I was just going to say that if there is some additional time granted with this, I don't mind puzzling over this a little bit longer.
Mr. Goodman?
Well, Dan, while we have you, and we can discuss this in public, I guess the concern I have following up on the statutory language that Commissioner Peterson just mentioned is, and by the way, I'm sympathetic to the result that you're trying to get at, but we are bound by our statutory language, okay? But just hear me out. What you're asking for is for us to redefine what URLs are on the World Wide Web so that political committees can say, go to someone else's website, Twitter's, to find out more about me. I mean, because you like the proposed answers in draft A to the subsequent questions that conclude Twitter is not your own website and therefore, under a strict reading of our regulations, you don't have to post a disclaimer there. Mm-hmm. You like that, and I think you accept our theory for that, which is, it's not your website. You don't control it. It's Twitter's website, okay? But now you're asking us to expand the notion of what a URL is on the World Wide Web to somebody else's website, which is Twitter's website. Now, maybe we should recognize the developments of technologies and change our regulation that way, but it strikes me in the meantime we've got a statute that says your website identifies you, and therefore, in the interest of disclaimers and informing people who is speaking, you need to direct them to your address or your URL. That is the web presence that you own and control. So react to that. What I'm seeing is a bit of an inconsistency in asking us to now broaden the definition of a URL as your identifier.
So if a bit.ly would be an acceptable mechanism as a URL, that's not that distinct from Twitter other than the fact that there's a static intermediary versus a direct channel, because I don't own bit.ly, they own it. They could change it anytime they want and not tell me about it. So I think if a bit.ly would work, and I think most people would say that it could, or any link shortener, then really Twitter is just a static intermediary version of that. I had a wonderful thought that popped into my head here when you were describing this. With respect to the Twitter. Darn it. You know when you have that wonderful book?
Well, I guess I have another question, and so maybe it'll come to you. Happens to me all the time. My wife's here today, and I can tell you, she'll tell you I have early onset dementia. Let me ask you, I just want to test a theory with you. Mm-hmm. What if the answer is through all traditional media, non-digital, including your own website, you got to use the permanent street address, telephone number, or World Wide Web address in the box disclaimer, the traditional box disclaimer, because our statute says so. You can always add in your preferred in that box or anywhere else, you can add in learn more about us at, and then post to channel people to your Twitter account rather than your main URL if you're interested in channeling people there, okay? And then as for device, for electronic and small electronic communications, it seems to me that perhaps no disclaimers required under the small items exemption.
So with the first part of that, the idea of, and learn more about us here, in my conversation with the professional communicators who create all these communications, they'll say that you want to have, if you want to be effective, you have to have one message, one ask. You don't want to just diverge from that. And every sort of interruption or hiccup you put in that way is going to cost you some number of responses. And I think somebody, I once heard this, that if for every additional click you have to do to get to a place, it's 3% loss rate. So having information that is not absolutely essential, that is neither part of the message nor essential to that message, is distracting from the core of that message. I get that we are required to have this disclaimer.
And that the problem you're indicating is inherent in having to have a disclaimer generally.
Right.
If I'm talking to the communication specialist, I might say, use the street address, which isn't going to channel anybody anywhere, and then use or the phone number.
But we want them to communicate with us. We don't want them not to.
And then add the Twitter feed to be the one place where people can communicate with us online.
So and this gets back to the idea that popped into my head before, and you just sort of mentioned again, is that the purpose of the disclaimer is to identify the speaker, and we agree. And the speaker is identified by the paid-for-by portion of the disclaimer. The URL portion of the disclaimer, or the phone number, or the address, is the communicative part of it. It's about, and here's how you get a hold of us. So it's, here's who we are, and here's how you can get a hold of us. And in the Committee to Defend the President's case, those are sort of two separate pieces. In Great America's case, that's one unified piece of messaging. So the identity component isn't what we're challenging. Obviously, you know, every communicator would love to not have to put anything in there that didn't actually communicate their message hands-on. We have to identify the speaker. But then in identifying the speaker, and that it's an independent communication, it's not authorized by a candidate, and here's how you get a hold of us, the least... Having one option that is as uniform as possible is the best. And having one option rather than giving people multiple places to go is the best for the quality of the communication. And to some limited extent, depending on the media, the time and space component involved, it also drives all the communications to one place, which is ultimately better. If I only have to pick up one response channel versus multiple ones, that's generally a good in the communicative space. And it achieves the objective of that component of the disclaimer requirement, which is not an identity component. It's a here's how you get a hold of me component.
Yes.
And so I think it's the differentiation. So we're not really arguing that you have to identify yourself. It's who you have to. And now here's the part we're going to shoot myself a little in the foot, unfortunately.
I would advise you as counsel not to do that.
The problem with the small items of exemption is that I can differentiate. If you're going to if I send you an email and you click on it, whether you're on a mobile device or a desktop device, I can control what page you hit, and that allows that might address the small items problem. I can't do that with Twitter. You're going to one Twitter. Twitter doesn't let me change your experience based on your platform. I can tell you that substantial and growing majority of utilization of political communications across all the different groups that I see, it's mobile. More and more people, it's already the majoritarian methodology. Desktop, laptops are going away. It's devices like cell phones or iPhones and tablets are substantially predominating, and it grows every single year by leaps and bounds. And so, and unfortunately, there's so much, fortunately, there's a lot of diversity in that marketplace, so there's not really a way. Our approach to the small items exemption is really to the extent that we have the graphic there. So it's not that we want to be exempted from the disclaimer. If we have to have a disclaimer, we don't want to be exempted from it. Rather, if we have to have a disclaimer, we want to be able to do it in the graphic, regardless of whether it would apply for the small items. But even though, as a practical matter, I can look at this thing and I can't read what that says right now on our page. It's just
it's a little bit too much, or rather, too small.
Mr. Chairman,
it's complex.
No, I appreciate the observations, and I'd like to consider Mr. Backer's points a little bit longer. I will just indicate this. Disclaimers for 40 years or more now we've heard the arguments that they distort people's message. There's forced speech. It takes up space. Takes up space in radio ads. I think it's an open question about where a disclaimer might take up the entire communicative space of a small item or a radio ad that might be a 10-second radio ad, and whether you even have space, whether it crowds out the whole message. I don't know that we're dealing with that here. And so, but I would like a little bit more time to consider the points that he has made, and so also the distinctions between the types of communications his committees may be considering, because I think there may be other regulatory implications that I hadn't thought of regarding the required disclaimer, for example, in small digital print.
Fair enough. Any objections? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick comment. I'm not intending to launch into a prolonged back and forth on this. I just want to, because we're going to be coming back to this issue, I can tell. I just want to state for the record that Commissioner Goodman is absolutely correct. We are bound by the statute to have certain disclaimers. I think we could potentially consider in a rulemaking context whether we can reinterpret some of those requirements. I'm not sure if we can, if we have that authority in the digital environment, or whether we want to make legislative recommendations. And it might be interesting, even if we were talking about legislative recommendations, to seek public comment, perhaps have a hearing. You know, this could be a very interesting topic. However, we currently have statute and rules on the books, and those are the ones that we have to apply. I am my plan is, you know, although we're not going to vote today, my current plan is to support draft B. The major difference is goes to whether a Twitter platform is your own web page or not. You know, unless you're Mark Zuckerberg, you're always on somebody else's platform. And whether it's Facebook or Twitter or whatever, I think that really these platforms, particularly, you know, Twitter, where people can have handles that are completely obscure. You know, you get no way of knowing who these people are, and they have these funny animal pictures as their avatars, and, you know, you just don't know. I think it's particularly important to have some kind of disclaimer requirement, which is completely feasible. It's completely feasible for these requesters. That's why we did the character count. You know, yes, in a hypothetical world where you had some other client or this client decided to change their current Twitter profile page, it might raise, you might have fewer characters, but, you know, you come to us with a specific request, and we interpret it under the facts that are given to us, which includes the status of your current platform profile page. So I think it's not actually terribly onerous, and that's sort of where I'm going with that, and I don't think I really need to say much else at this point, since we're all going to come back to it.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Becker, is anything further for today, anyway?
I would just briefly note that, you know, as both drafts recognize, the Internet has completely changed the nature of political communications, and really all communications, and that Twitter is an incredibly powerful platform by which we engage in political debate. And while I've been sitting here, Michael Beckel in the back has tweeted, Dan Becker of @political_lawdb, @GreatAmericanPacTreasures, arguing using Twitter handle would save space, enable more speech/content. People use Twitter to engage in the political discussion, and we really ought to encourage it rather than not. So, and I hope he retweets that. So,
all right, fair enough. Thanks very much. We'll continue this at some other time. How about an hour and a half? We'll come back at 2:30. 2:30 to 4. Fair enough. Give us an hour and a half in the afternoon. All right.